Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this broadcast is World Watchers. It is program number 780, November 17th, 1986. There's been a lot in the news the past 2 weeks about the National Security Council and also about Ronald Reagan's concern with them for sending arms to Iran, one of the motives being that the Ayatollah Khomeini isn't going to be around too long, and they wanted to be sure that the team that followed him, whoever followed him, would be close to the Western world again, close to the United States. What they didn't mention that is that Ayatollah Khomeini is only 86 years old, and he happens to be the younger brother of a gentleman named Pasandide. It's spelled P-A-S-A-N-D-E-D-E. The older brother lives in the city of Qom, Q-O-M. It's the holy city where all the mosques are, well-known for the mosques. And according to a friend of mine who came from Iran and has family and friends there as well as in this country, said that the older brother writes to Ayatollah Khomeini. He sends him letters. He scolds him. He advises him in the tradition that an older brother would do it, and that he still is able, got all his rockers, I guess, to tell the other one what to be doing or not doing. I think that one of the problems with this country is that we sit and devise who will be the backup or the cushion or the net or who should we replace for the person in power, and that never seems right to us. Why don't we try to get along with the person that's in power, and then the following transition wouldn't be so hard in spending so much time making war with the people that we don't like, try to find the things we have in common. I'm sure there'd be more than we would admit to, just as after the war in Germany, look how well Germany and Japan got along with the United States, and each country had spent 30 years getting ready to arm for the war, and when it was over, they became instant friends. It's a shame that there's so much waste of life and property and pollution on planet Earth with weapons and ideas of conceiving how to erase each other when there's no reason, actually, there are a lot of reasons we could get along, no reason why we shouldn't try. As a matter of fact, Ayatollah Khomeini, with that track record of his family, may outlive Ronald Reagan. You know, with the colon cancer he had and with the Teflon peeling off, it might be very painful. He may not be able to take that, and he better shut up about who to replace Khomeini. Maybe he won't even be around to know about it. This is the 22nd anniversary of the assassination of John Kennedy, this coming Saturday, November 22nd. I've been studying that assassination for 22 years, come next Saturday. And the interesting thing to me is the synchronicity of events in my personal life, small ones, small events and large ones. And at this particular time on the anniversary of John Kennedy's death, the National Security Council is getting an exposure it never had. And many people talk about the role of the CIA in the assassinations. And beyond the CIA, there are higher levels, and the National Security is the important agency. The secret government, apart from the State Department, the Defense Department, just its own little branch that decides who lives and who dies. Now, there's a lot of irony in the Kennedy assassination and in the National Security Council. The exposure is coming at this time and in the history of it because Joseph Kennedy, the father of John Kennedy, was one of the 12 group of men who sat with Herbert Hoover, former president of the United States, and created the National Security Council, the very body that would be offing his son not many years later. There is a book report on the Organization of National Security. It's called the Hoover Commission Report on Organization of the Executive Branch of the Government, published by McGraw-Hill, New York, in 1949. And in this book, it explains that it's a very formal book. It's a report put together by ex-President Herbert Hoover, retired, who immediately after the war began to reorganize the executive office so that it would have the exact secrecy and do the things that it is doing now with all of the loopholes. Now, Herbert Hoover was instrumental in preparing Germany to rearm and the United States to rearm for the war against Russia after the Russian Revolution because of the billions of dollars of property he had there. For one thing, he had personal financial reasons, and he got the Solidarists and the White Russians, the very people that were involved in the murder of John Kennedy later, to come to this country and after World War II. But Herbert Hoover was very instrumental in setting up World War II. And when World War II was over, the company was formed. I've cited that before on broadcast, the British American Commerce Corporation, Canadian Corporation, where over 600 businesses and firms would literally control the resources of factories and possessions and minerals and so forth that come out of the earth, or the telegraph and inventions later, the monopolies of those kinds of things for controlling the world. And when, after the British American Canadian Corporation was formed, the National the Hoover Commission set up with 12 people to get a tight hold on the executive office and separated. This was the wedge that separated it and the Constitution and removed it from the legislative and judicial bodies that were traditionally protected by our Constitution. And on the board, among those people working very close with Herbert Hoover, was Joseph Kennedy, the former ambassador to Great Britain. He had been pro-German. He was known for his sympathetic ideas towards Adolf Hitler. And as soon as Hitler was defeated and the war was over, provisions were set up to combine this time the Western world, British and American, with Adolf Hitler and make war against the Soviet Union. Another person on that commission was Dean Acheson, who became Secretary of State from 1949 to 53. He helped build, he was the main architect of post-war, Cold War, economic war against Russia, and it was called part of the containment, holding Russia down, and went into the Truman Document, the Marshall Plan, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, and he was part of the policies that led to the United States intervention in Korea. When we went into Korea in 1950, this is the beginning of a period from 1950, then the Southeast Asian War, and then going into a lot of other countries and doing operations of overthrowing them and doing murders and coups, the use of our troops after World War II, the first place was in Korea. And as then Dean Acheson also was in favor of arming West Germany, along with John J. McClure of the Warren Commission. And Mr. Dean Acheson and Joseph Kennedy and Herbert Hoover were three of the very important members of the Hoover Commission to set up that loophole in the executive branch of government whereby the executive office could be separated. And with the erosion of this power from the Constitution, there came other ways to separate not only the legislative, the executive, rather, the branch of the government, but to give it more muscle and more power. One of the best articles on the movement of power in the secret team has just come out in Freedom Magazine by Fletcher Prouty. And I'll do more on that article later. I'm just running through certain ideas on national security now. But in this article from October 1986, The Erosion of National Sovereignty, it goes into the use of John Kennedy to restructure the government after the Bay of Pigs. He began to break the CIA apart and also to have a national security action team. He made a national security action memorandum, and documents came from the White House that reflected the decisions of the National Security Council and the president, and then covert operations began to escalate, and the 1954 National Security Council, well on its way after it was formed in 1947, formed what is known as a special group, the 5412 Committee of the Vice President, people high up in Defense Department, State Department, the Director of the CIA. Then John Kennedy, ironically, created the Defense Intelligence Agency. He broke up the CIA and wanted to tear it to shreds. So July the 11th, 1961, Kennedy, in downgrading the CIA, formed the Defense Intelligence Agency. Secretary McNamara created the Defense Intelligence Agency for him, the Secretary of Defense, and an Air Force general, Joseph F. Carroll, formerly the FBI, became the first leader. Now, the irony of this whole story of the assassination of John Kennedy and the saga of the Kennedys lies in that Joe Kennedy helped set up this National Security Council, which isolated the executive branch of the government and gave them the right to kill any heads of states, to have a meeting of four or five people and decide what country should be overthrown, who lives and who died. And then John Kennedy, in breaking up the CIA, allowed the Defense Department, and he seemed to trust the Defense Department more than this group from the intelligence community that was put together after World War II. The OSS became the CIA. So being traditional, he forms a Defense Intelligence Agency, which even is different than the action in the Pentagon or general war-making machinery, it has its own special clique so that the Defense Intelligence Agency and the National Security Council could do the murders of political leaders before John Kennedy and after John Kennedy. His father created one group, he created the other, then both were used to kill him and his brother, which is really ironic. Now, there were very interesting articles this week pertaining to the Iranian story, and I want to cite four of them because they seem so much like the material you hear on World Watchers, but it's nice to hear it from somebody else for a once in a, for a first time, I should say. These are first stories for me to read in this way pertaining to the news of Iran, the national security, and some raw nerves of our government have been exposed. The one of the first stories I want to read actually is called The Revolt of the Colonels by Richard Reeves. It came out in the Monterey Herald, but I believe it's carried in the Washington Post. This is the way it reads. Has there been a coup d'etat in Washington? And keep in mind, he's asking this in 1986. There was one in 1963, but at least he's recognizing it. I'll begin and not interrupt it again. Has there been a coup d'etat in Washington? Who is Colonel North, Colonel Oliver North, and why is he running my country? Who pays Eugene Hassenfuss and the others to deliver machine guns and rockets around the world in our name? Who was Robert McFarlane? What was he doing in Iran? Who is the Army Colonel who runs the Office of Public Diplomacy to spread propaganda about Central America in the United States? He's referring to an agency that was exposed this week for being created by the National Security Council that lied to Congress in order for Congress to give $100 million to the Contras. On that basis, and being as the money isn't distributed yet, I think the money should be pulled back and not given and open up this story because they lied and admittedly lied in order to get the money. It's the Office of Public Diplomacy out of the National Security Council. What are all the colonels doing in Honduras? Richard Reeves said. They are at our, in quotes, temporary installation. What is the truth? Members of the administration are systematically lying to Congress. They are systematically lying to the world. They may be systematically lying to their own leaders. Obviously, it is no big deal for them to lie to nobodies like the rest of us. We can't even be sure who they are. Is President Reagan the administration, or are the colonels running our country? The mysterious Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, whose personal military records have been classified to keep them away from the press, but who seems to have power to conduct secret and private wars and diplomacy on two sides of the globe, was profiled, as well as could be without direct information, in the New York Times last Sunday. In quotes, he was described as a bright, articulate officer with a gung-ho spirit who saw the world in black and white. He took part in what one official called the education of Ronald Reagan, who had come to the White House with little military experience. What exactly was the education of Ronald Reagan? Is someone trying to say that North and former National Security Advisor Richard McFarlane had somehow brainwashed our president into seeing the world as colonels see it? McFarlane is a colonel from the Marines also. Who knows in this brave new world where colonels are assigned to the State Department to run public diplomacy offices? They are apparently better equipped because they bring the modern military's attitude toward putting spin on information. Well, we're going to have a tough time for a while explaining what happened, said a department spokesman on Sunday. They use what they call the spin to turn things around. They certainly will, considering that the State Department and the White House have issued this declaration last May 6th to define the United States policy regarding hostages. The United States government will make no concessions to terrorists. It will not pay any ransom, release prisoners, change the policies, or agree to other acts that might encourage terrorism. This State Department may actually be in a better position to know what has happened and what is happening than the appointed leadership of the Department of Defense, the supposed supervisors of our activist colonels. Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger went to China last month, urged the Chinese not to ship arms to Iran. He apparently didn't know that the people he was talking to were part of Colonel North's plot to do the very thing that they had been shipping arms to Iran. I wonder what the Chinese think now. None of us knows what to think unless you happen to think that it is a good idea to turn the country over to the colonels and give them the power to do whatever they want and the right to lie to the rest of us about it. But if they're in charge, and it doesn't matter what we think, If we're in charge, the colonel should be in front if elected and represent elected. We should have elected officials and not colonels. And they should be in front of those who are elected officials and television cameras and explain under oath, like the rest of the others, what they thought they were doing with our country. Another article by Warren Hinkle in San Francisco Examiner this week. He was a former editor of Ramparts magazine in California. It's been a long time since Ramparts was out. It's called Teflon No More. Egg has stuck to the Teflon face of Ronald Reagan. It's not a pretty sight even for an actor to have a dirty puss. It never was. The revelations of last week disclosed the former light bulb salesman in the White House to be little more than a benign bumbler who puts on a happy face about running his country's foreign policy while the real power is in the hands of a pair of trigger-fingered colonels possessed of a banana republic mentality. It is deeply humiliating, fundamentally embarrassing time for the United States. The president of this putative advise and consent democracy, in his clearly onrushing senility, has already a pair of conniving colonels who couldn't find first base in the dark with a flashlight to determine the authority of his Secretary of State and Defense, who would have been kicked around like a pair of junkyard dogs over the utterly mad policy of appeasing the fanatical theocrats in Iran by giving them arms against all premises of American policy and moral fiber. In the dismal and futile hope that the bully boys would free American hostages in time for Reagan's sinking party to gain points in the recent election, which they lost. It is a rather delicious time for the sweaty-browed, blustering apologist for Ronald Reagan as president, who will go down as a rosebud rather than a toilet bulb in history, to do the manly thing and fall upon their swords. One relished the performance of the dreadful Robert Novak on CNN the other evening, doing his usual red-baiting number, asking rhetorically in the president's defense, if you would believe these half-baked Arab journalists talking about secret arms swaps for hostages in Iran as against the word of the President of the United States? It turned out that the half-baked Arab journalists were utterly accurate in what they reported, to the dismay of every hard hat and redneck in the country, who believed Reagan when he said Jimmy Carter was a wimp and he would never negotiate with terrorists. It was left for the great actor to go on television Thursday night with a bad script and make a most unconvincing plea that he had not secretly shipped arms to the Iranians for the hostages, but only for the high principles of state, which only the president and the colonels, who seemed to have taken a Rasputin-like hold over the man, understood. The Secretary of State didn't understand it, the Secretary of Defense didn't understand it, the State Department didn't understand it, and the devious CIA naturally lied about it. Trust me, said Teflon Ron, but this time the country didn't trust him. Nobody seems to believe Ronald Reagan anymore. One of the colonels who seemed to have taken possession of the old actor's soul, the insidious Colonel Robert McFarlane, was the architect of the appease the great Satan haters in Iran policy, who did or did not, according to the reports, sneak into Iran disguised with a cake and a Bible signed by Ronald Reagan, and is best known by the nature of his mammoth foolishness. Lesser known but even more invidious is Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, Jr. of the National Security Council. Incidentally, it was Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North and McFarlane and these gentlemen that I defined last week as being involved not only in Iran but in the Nicaragua Hasanfus affair and arming Nicaragua against the laws of Congress, and they're breaking laws here in Iran. These are the same people. Warren Hinkle said, Lieutenant Oliver North of the National Security Council went with Colonel McFarlane on that failed trip to kiss the feet of the Satan haters and is the man whose phone number in the White House is for every bloodthirsty Contra in Central America. They can always call McFarlane and North collect. McFarlane was the architect of the Reagan administration that circumvented their own people and the sanctions we have sold to our allies to play the foolish game for the hostage takers of Iran. Lieutenant Colonel North, who is sort of an E. Howard Hunt of the regime of the Reagan administration, takes pleasure in wearing wigs, disguises, traveling under false passports, and engages in daring do. He was the architect of the lawless administration against the role of Congress, against the law of the land, continuing to supply terrorist forces in Central America when their funds were cut off. And, of course, Hinkle thinks they should retire with the president. Carl Rowan wrote in his syndicated column, "The White House gang, the current flap over arms for hostages dealing with Iran, ought to awaken Americans to one truth. The arrogant, often secret conduct of foreign policy by a small clique of, in Reagan, in the White House, that is close to disaster. Against the advice of the Pentagon and Congress, the United States Marines were sent to Beirut. 241 of them met their death there. In defiance of restrictions voted by Congress, by rulings of the World Court, by the United Nations vote, by the American public opinion, under direction of the White House and the national security, these people, these colonels, have waged a secret war against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. The clandestine schemes to arm Contra rebels in Nicaragua came to light recently." Well, that's not true. It's been in the news for 4 years. "This caper subjected the United States to ridicule and contempt in Central and South America, where American prestige is low and worrisome." No sooner had the White House warriors gotten caught in a brazen disinformation campaign regarding Libya that it was launching an incredible misinformation campaign to convince Americans that the disaster of the summit in Reykjavik again was a triumph after disinformation in Libya and Reykjavik. Then we had another explanation of lies in Central and South America. "This country has a State Department," Carl Rowan says. "It has a Department of Defense. It has the Joint Chief of Staff of the military and the Central Intelligence Agency and the U.S. Information Agency, Foreign Affairs and Oversight Committees in Congress. A variety of advice is needed to prevent a president or a small band of his aides from committing serious blunders. We are seeing the damage that occurs when the president, who doesn't know enough about world powers, ignores the advice of the above-mentioned agencies and lets a less-than-competent White House clique run amok. The business of national security advisor playing fast and loose secretly is not new. It started with Henry Kissinger, and he explains he's flying around in Europe and not even telling the Secretary of State William Rogers where he's going and what he is doing. Kissinger had Richard Nixon's approval. Congress will probably pass a law requiring Senate confirmation of the president's national security advisor. That step is decades overdue, but a lot more is required to halt the dangerous business of a White House palace guard grabbing wigs and cloaks and daggers and Bibles and making their own deals and waging their private wars and in the process destroying the credibility and the reputation of this nation." And that's Carl Rowan asking about this gang. Another article, just one more on this subject, and particularly on pointing out the secret team that's behind these actions. George Will wrote, "Who makes policy?" And this is what Mr. Mikhail Gorbachev asked 2 weeks ago, and I answered. And I'll give you a detailed answer in a few minutes to the question, "Who makes policy?" This is November the 13th. Does that poor angular gentleman that he's describing, Uncle Sam, who leans against a post, our Uncle Sam, he should be standing tall, but he's not standing tall at all, were it not for the lamppost. It's been a 2-month toot, and it's a dangerous thing to see him, he says, you know, limping down here against the post. This nation's foreign policy, a surrender, began in September when the administration was seized by another hostage obsession, the Danilov debacle, culminated in an improvised summit at which the gravest issues, the elimination of ballistic missiles, the elimination of nuclear weapons, were raised in a manner so slapdash that no one seems sure what happened. If the administration really believes it came close to world-transforming agreements in Iceland, is that it has an unconservative tendency to exaggerate the tractability of the world, or a dangerous penchant for improvisation and chaos in the policy-making procedures. And chaos begets chaos. He brings up the question of the hurried meeting in Iceland, because I did several broadcasts, too, just on Danilov alone, to say that he caused this meeting, and therefore he is very important to the president of the United States. He's been blackmailed. And George Will is saying the president is a hostage to the Soviet Union and had to go to a quick meeting in Iceland because of the Danilov affair. He doesn't venture into what it is, but he makes note of that, and I considered it very, very important. Then he says, within days of the Danilov swap, hostage David Jacobson was seen on videotape denouncing the administration for not doing much for Americans in Lebanon, as was done by Danloff. Imagine the brisk business in hostages now that weapons are the coin of commerce. If the Iranian episode has come to light, just as Democrats are coming to power in Senate, the power of investigation, even more than the legislation, may be the principal Senate thorn in the administration's side. And this is George Will, a strong conservative. There's going to be a long, lively row about the wisdom of trading arms for hostages, of trading with Iranians through Israeli intermediaries, certainly paying for hostages in the coin of military material, United States spare parts. The necessity for making a policy choice is wrong doing it this way. Iran can get necessities and still remain hostile to the United States. What we have to demand is scrutiny. And how did we get into this U.S. policy? How is it made? And he says, in the Iranian episode, someone seems to have rummaged in the Smithsonian's attic and dusted off not only a Henry Kissinger insight, but also a Kissinger style. Iran is, in Kissinger's formulation, the China of the 90s. That is, Iran will be what China was in the 70s, a large, important nation, contiguous to the Soviet Union and therefore in need of Western friendship. That formulation is timely coming from Henry Kissinger, who is National Security Advisor, did a sweeping end run around and was unaware of Secretary William Rogers in preparing the opening to China 15 years ago. And George Will brings up the Henry Kissinger tactics used in the National Security Council, and Karl Rowan does too, and it's very important because Henry Kissinger's people are very much behind the manipulation of the president by way of the National Security Council. There was a story, many of you probably saw this large one this week, Admiral William J. Crow, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was never told about our arming Iran that's been going on, first by way of Israel and later by the United States for the past 5 years. Another story, United States company sold helicopter parts to Iran. The company is United Technology Corporation, and that's the company that Alexander Haig was president of before he became Secretary of State. And then there's articles about probing the illegality of the Iranian deal and the fact that shipping the arms is illegal. The national security doesn't count. They don't inform the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They can sell parts through the companies of their own members that are close to the council. And another article in the New York Times, many laws bear on arms shipments to Iran, and it lists a lot of problems, legalities that should bring this president and all of them out of office. But he, I'm sure, will charm his way out of that and stay not happily for the next few years. Now, the importance of the National Security Council, that these four men are writing about and acting so innocent, you know, like little virgins out of a whorehouse or something. They've been around a long time, but all of a sudden it hits them what kind of a power branch they've become. The way they use their power is evidenced in a very brilliant article, wonderful article that came out this last Sunday in the San Jose Mercury by Alfonso Chardy, called Reagan Has Okayed 40 Covert Operations, at least 40, maybe up to 70 covert operations since 1981 when he was president. And of course, these kinds of things were done, some with the CIA, some with congressional approval, but they've been going on, and in just 6 years, he's been doing a lot of hanky-panky abroad and at home. The article says that President Reagan, in 6 years of office, has approved of 50 secret operations. The events took place at home, abroad, and they involved arming anti-communist rebels, helping stage a successful revolution, manipulating elections, mounting propaganda campaigns, blocking supplies to guerrillas, swapping weapons for American hostages. In the United States, the administration influenced the press on Central America and monitored Americans opposed to U.S. policies. And it goes into activities that Ronald Reagan started in 1981. The CIA in 1981 secretly funneled $10 million in cash to overthrow the government of Chad. In 1981, they were trying to overthrow Ethiopia and send CIA money and propaganda into Ethiopia. The covert action continued. This arms shipment in Iran began. According to this article, in March 1981, Reagan's involvement with Iran dates back to March 81, when the CIA briefers advised that White House and Senate intelligence that Reagan had authorized a plan for the opponents against Ayatollah Khomeini. Now, in 6 years, I've done a lot of programs on activities that I believed were involved with the National Security Council and fingered them right back to there. And you can see that if they admit that they've been involved in 50 to 60 operations, that I've had a busy 6 years, and you know I have. And a lot of the ones they're admitting here aren't the obvious ones. They admit Ethiopia because Vernon Walters had to go over there and rescue a CIA person from Ethiopia. We'll take a one-minute break and go back to the National Security Council and the role it plays in controlling our government, other governments, assassinations. Very timely with, as I say, with the assassination of John Kennedy, the anniversary this week, and the exposure of the National Security Council to the media in general, in case they didn't see it before. After the one-minute break, we'll come back to these subjects.